Hello and welcome to a bonus episode of Conspiracy You Can Believe In. If you listened to the last episode, that one was about the death of Dag Hammarskjöld. He was the Secretary General of the UN who died mysteriously in a plane crash in 1961 over modern-day Zambia in Africa. And at the end of the episode, we started to talk a little bit about a group called SIMAR, the South African Institute of Maritime Research, which was this very shadowy mercenary company in South Africa during the apartheid era that historian Susan Williams started to dig into to try to find some kind of connection to the crash that killed Dag Hammarskjöld, which many people who have investigated the crash, including the UN, now increasingly believe that his plane was shot down or brought down in some way. So I said at the end of that that I'd do a bonus episode about apartheid South Africa because they have shown up in a couple different episodes that I've done. I believe they were connected to the Olof Palme murder in 1987. That was the second episode I did. And they may or may not have had some connection to the Dag Hammarskjöld case, too. South Africa is something that I've started to get some interest in, just as, you know, I grew up in Alabama. The more that I thought about it, I felt like it had kind of a similar history in a lot of ways, with a lot of parallels between Jim Crow and apartheid. And the more that I learned about it, I found that there was this whole world of stuff I didn't know. And what I use for a lot of research on this is a television program from the 90s called TRC Special Report. And what that was a weekly news show that summarized the Truth and Reconciliation Commission's public hearing from that week, all throughout the 90s. I didn't watch all the episodes, but I watched a couple dozen of them and started to learn a lot about what South Africa went through, because that was the entire point of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. South Africa had a new regime, finally a democratic regime, starting in 1994, and the goal of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was to get all of the atrocities that were committed under the old regime out in the open so that people knew about it and so that the country could move forward. So I decided I should probably do a bonus episode on South Africa, since I've mentioned it in a couple episodes by now, and maybe this would give a little more background. And again, I have to say this with a caveat, I'm not an expert. I've watched a ton of TRC Special Report, basically over the past year or so, and have read a little bit about South Africa. I should also say up front, this is a bonus episode, so there's no conspiracy here. Most of everything that I'm saying is stuff that was investigated by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. This is stuff that actually happened. You also might have noticed that this isn't a scripted episode. I just have some notes that I'm just kind of talking over. Another thing I want to point out, some of the stuff I'm going to talk about here is pretty heavy stuff. A lot of murder, a lot of racist violence, pretty heavy things. So if you don't want to listen to stuff about that, just skip this one. So yeah, let's start off with just a little bit about South Africa. For starters, South Africa is a pretty diverse place. There is a substantial white minority, and those are descended from English colonists as well as Dutch colonists, or, you know, groups of French and German and other continental Europeans who settled in a Dutch colony and ended up speaking Dutch. Today, this language is known as Afrikaans, which is kind of like a sort of a dialect of Dutch, kind of sort of its own language. And so you have a white community that's divided between English speakers and Afrikaans speakers. There's also an ethnic group, the colored people, which sounds very weird to Americans, but this is what the group calls themselves. They are people of mixed European and African and sometimes Southeast Asian, in some cases, or Indian descent, that have kind of created their own culture in South Africa. And the majority of the population is Black African. And there's a ton of different languages and people groups within that in Africa. you know, the Zulu, Sotho people, Tswana. And one other thing I should say is I am definitely going to mispronounce a lot of names here. I apologize up front. I don't speak any of the languages of South Africa, so please just bear with me and let me know if I really butcher something. So all of these people today are in what became known after 1994 as the Rainbow Nation. They all have an identity as South African. It's one person, one vote. But it certainly wasn't that way before 1994. You might have grown up hearing about apartheid, but especially if you're much younger and it wasn't really part of something that you heard about or saw in the news as an adult, like if you're my age, you might not really know a lot about it. So what was apartheid and how did it start? Well, the official program of apartheid began in 1948 when a group called the National Party, this was a right-wing, whites-only party that was largely led by Afrikaans speakers. They came into power in 1948, passed a series of laws that effectively officially segregated the society. It was always a colonial nation that was governed by whites, but apartheid really set things into stone. The black majority could not vote. They had special internal passports that governed where they could work and where they could live. They could only use certain public spaces separate from whites. In a lot of ways, it was pretty similar to Jim Crow in the American South, except in this situation, black South Africans are and always were the vast majority of the population. So you had this small white minority maintaining complete control of the country over an overwhelming black majority. And so that started in 1948, officially under apartheid. There began to be protests against it, especially picked up during the 60s. Especially young people came out against it. There began to be organized groups against apartheid, like the ANC. I'll say that acronym a lot. It stands for the African National Congress. Of course, if you probably know Nelson Mandela, that was his political party. They were an underground organization during apartheid. And they began to organize against it. There are also other black consciousness organizations that were separate from the ANC that organized against apartheid. One of the first big flare-ups that it was kind of a turning point for the apartheid system and the organization against it was the Sharpeville Massacre in 1960. There was a protest in a township that was majority black in South Africa, called Sharpeville, and the South African police brutally repressed it. They opened fire, killed dozens of people. And when that happened, the opposition to apartheid decided to go underground and to form armed wings, so people that would openly fight against the apartheid regime. The ANC had a group called Umkhonto we Sizwe, which is usually shortened to MK, and it means Spear of the Nation. They were basically like a separate army that was part of the ANC, and they organized bombings of infrastructure, military bombings. They had an armed forces basically that, you know, fought against South Africa in their overseas wars, and that's really when that started, was 1960, after the Sharpeville Massacre. And that's also when, in the 60s, is when apartheid began to be connected to the Cold War in general. Starting in 1968, South Africa had a defense minister named P.W. Botha. And Botha would go on to become president in the 80s. But when he was defense minister, he started this political theory called Total Onslaught. And what Total Onslaught was he believed that South Africa was under threat from within, from these student organizations, from black-led unions, to just protesters in general, and from enemies without. And he saw that as communism. He began to connect the existence of the apartheid regime to the Cold War. And he saw South Africa and maintaining this white rule as a front of the Cold War, that it was necessary to maintain apartheid or otherwise, you know, the communists are going to come in. And this is how you're going to see in the 80s, where they would try to get support from right-wing organizations and governments, like in the U.S. and Britain. But the idea of total onslaught completely took over how the apartheid government of South Africa decided to meet with any kind of dissent. They used the police. They used secret branches of the police and secret military units, the military itself, to basically engage in open state terror against anyone who is opposed to the apartheid regime. And that's not just people who were taking arms against the apartheid regime, like Umkhonto we Sizwe, but it also included professors, student leaders, just any activists in general. People would be assassinated, they could be taken into police stations and disappeared, tortured, put in prison. This is how P.W. Botha saw the strategy. He saw total onslaught against the way of life, so to speak, of apartheid, and that it had to be met with massive repression. So this really picked up in the late 70s. 1976, there was a student and youth uprising all throughout South Africa, but in Soweto, the southwest township near Johannesburg, there was a big student uprising that the South African police absolutely crushed and committed terrible atrocities. You know, they opened fire on it. They killed hundreds of people, mostly young people, in this demonstration. And then the next year, the South African police arrested and imprisoned a man named Stephen Biko. Stephen Biko was a black political leader. He was very charismatic, very popular, and he was the leading light of this idea known as black consciousness, which was to form which was to instill a positive identity of blackness among the majority black South African population, and to use that as like a political weapon for their own liberation. He got arrested in 1977 by the South African police. He was shackled in prison, beaten, and tortured to death while he was in prison. This was a very common fate for many South African liberation movement leaders, as well as just rank and file activists. Now, when that happened, the world knew who Stephen Biko was already, and it was very clear that South African police had murdered him. And the South African police tried to cover it up. The government tried to cover it up. They had their own phony investigation, saying, well, you know, of course he wasn't killed. This was an accident. He fell and hit his head or something like that. And just wouldn't entertain any idea that he had been murdered in prison, even though everyone knew what happened. And this is, it's kind of like a microcosm of the apartheid regime, that everyone knew what was going on. Everyone knew that there was this brutal military regime that repressed any dissent, and that's the only way that it could exist. But the white population just kind of went along with it. And I feel like this, incidents like this are why the Truth and Reconciliation Commission happened after it ended, was to get everything like this out in the open, because the government was just so prone to lying about everything. In the 80s, it got even worse, because by this point, the opposition to apartheid began to coalesce around groups like the UDF, which is the United Democratic Front. Before the 80s, there was a constellation of different unions and student groups and different groups locally that opposed apartheid, but now they began to go under the same banner. And the ANC, the African National Congress, really began to organize, build influence and momentum. So the South African government responded with police brutality, with internal espionage and spying on their own residents, and most importantly, state terror. And we'll talk about that when I talk about some of the specific things that the South African government did. Foreign policy-wise, this is when South Africa gets embroiled in civil wars that are happening in Africa. They get involved in one in Mozambique starting in the 70s, and they get embroiled in a civil war in Angola. Now, the government of Angola was a Marxist-Leninist government at that time. They were anti-colonial, but they were fighting against a group to the south called UNITA that was pro-Western and anti-communist. They get backed up by South Africa, and it kind of becomes a proxy war of the Cold War in South Africa. This is kind of like the apartheid South Africa's Vietnam. They send a lot of troops over to Angola to fight in that war, and there is also one in present-day Namibia. Back then, it was called Southwest Africa. It was literally a colony of apartheid South Africa, but it had an independence movement called SWAPO, or the Southwest Africa People's Organization, and it became an open war against the apartheid regime. So they had two major wars going on throughout the 80s. This, of course, heightened tensions at home, but they tried to use these wars abroad as a way to get support from right-wing politicians and governments that, like, look, we're fighting against communists. It's not really about, you know, apartheid. This is about us being anti-communist. So the apartheid identity was always tied in with this idea of anti-communism. But apartheid didn't last forever. One of the strategies to deal with total onslaught was just piecemeal reforms. In the 80s, they started to allow the Indian population. There's a large Indian population in South Africa, and people from the colored ethnicity to serve in government and to vote, but they didn't allow the franchise to the majority black population. From the beginning in apartheid, they had these things called Bantustans, which were basically fake governments that they set up and set aside for selected leaders within the black community. And the goal was, well, we'll just push the black population to these small little states, and the white population can have the rest of the country. It was fake political representation, the Bantustans, and it was widely criticized. But these are the kind of things that the government was doing. But by 1990, you know, the writing was on the wall. The ANC was unbanned. Previously, they had been an illegal organization. And violence was still continuing, but it was very clear the momentum was going towards a democratic South Africa, one way or the other. And in 1994, they had their first free and fair elections. Nelson Mandela became president, and the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was introduced. Now, what exactly is this? Because I mentioned it a couple times, but it may not be clear. This was a special set of commissions that were based on restorative justice. So you had one commission that was just for hearing crimes. People would come forward, they would say, you know, this happened to me in 1983, this person did it, I want them to come forward to the commission and say what they did. Or someone, you know, my brother was disappeared in prison, and these were all public meetings. They would go up to a microphone and say what happened to them, a huge hall, and it traveled around the country. And that was the idea, so that it would be televised every week on TRC Special Report. These meetings would be open to the public, and people could know just what it was that the apartheid regime did. But of course, it wasn't just the Truth Commission. You also had the idea of reconciliation. So they had another commission for granting amnesty. And this was the more controversial part of TRC. People that committed crimes against humanity could get amnesty. They didn't have to go to prison. They didn't have to pay civil fees. They would just get up and they would say what they did, and they could walk away free. But there was a catch. They had to, A, give a full disclosure. They couldn't hide anything. They couldn't try to lie about it. And if they got caught, you know, they had a commission that could deny them amnesty. The other thing was that they had to be part of a recognized either political group or political ideology, and the crime that they committed had to be a political one. So you couldn't just get up there and try to get amnesty for, like, a murder that you committed that wasn't political. It had to be related to apartheid in some way. You know, most of the crimes committed under apartheid were from the government, but there were some killings that happened within the liberation movement, too. If someone was accused of being a police informant and murdered, for instance, or there were some bombings that Umkhonto Wesizwe did that did kill civilians. Not nearly as many civilians killed by the South African government, but this did happen. This was open war, a low-level civil war that was raging pretty much from 1960 until 1994. So there were a lot of cases that were brought before the TRC. And it went on from the founding of the New South Africa until 2000. They had their final cases in 1999. That was the other deal behind the TRC, was that it had to be limited in time. They couldn't just keep it going on forever. There were some critics of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. These include people like the family of Stephen Biko. Stephen Biko's family wanted the people that did that crime to be brought to justice in a court. And there were many people, many families of victims that wanted the perpetrators not to get amnesty. So what were some of the crimes that were uncovered by the TRC throughout the 1990s? Well, the South African police and military, they used a lot of brutal methods to crush dissent and to fight against groups, liberation groups like the ANC. And these included police brutality that happened on a massive scale. One of the tactics was mass arrests throughout the 1980s, especially of young black people. A significant percentage of the people arrested throughout the 1980s were under the age of 25. These people would be brought to prisons where they could be tortured, they could be disappeared, they could just be straight up murdered. This happened a lot. It happened to a lot of people, and detention without trial was legal in South Africa for up to 6 months. So you could get arrested and just be gone for 6 months, and there was nothing you could do about it. One of the other ways that the South African military was able to exact revenge on dissent was cross-border raids. So anti-apartheid activists often exiled themselves from South Africa to avoid police repression or threats to their own life. Sometimes they would move to Lesotho or Zimbabwe, and South African military units would just walk right into these countries, just go next door across the border, find their target, and indiscriminately kill along their way. Like, there was one raid in Maseru in Lesotho where they just killed 40 people, men, women, and children, anyone they found, near the house where they were trying to find this one person. In response to that raid, the ANC began to bomb non-military targets on a few occasions. One in particular was the Durban beachfront bombing, where there was a beachfront bar in the city of Durban that was frequented by South African police. The ANC couldn't reach police headquarters with a car bomb, so they planted it at the bar, and there were civilians killed. This is not normally what the ANC did, but, you know, I think it's important to recognize that this was war. I obviously don't condone civilians getting killed, but we have this idea that apartheid ended through peaceful means, and it did not. Things got bombed. People, infrastructure, and military targets were destroyed, but also there was terror. And I think it's important to recognize that the apartheid regime was not brought down peacefully. And that's part of the reason why the Truth and Reconciliation Commission happened, because they needed to establish legitimacy for this new democratic government and just have it out in the open what happened, why it happened, and why the country needed to move forward. One of the other ways the South African police and intelligence services carried out their state terror was through mail bombs. And this is one of the hardest ones to watch, the hardest parts to watch from TRC Special Report, because it is really just a terrifying prospect. They targeted anti-apartheid activists who were living overseas. People like Eugene de Kock and this guy Craig Williamson, who I talked about both of these people in episode 2, because I think they're both connected to the murder of Olof Palme. People have suspected Craig Williamson in particular. He was questioned by Swedish police at the time. He was kind of like the top spy of apartheid South Africa. He organized mail bombings of political dissidents like Ruth First. She was the wife of the South African Communist Party leader, Joe Slovo. He sent a mail bomb to Ruth First and killed her. He also killed Jeanette and Katrin Schoen. Jeanette was the wife, and Katrin was the six-year-old daughter of Marius Schoen. The Schoens were Afrikaners, but they were anti-apartheid activists. They were involved with the ANC. And Craig Williamson, when he was undercover, was involved in their student organization. He rose up in the ranks of this anti-apartheid organization the entire time being a plant for the South African government. Jeanette Schoon found him out, or at least suspected him of being undercover, and Craig Williamson had to flee. And then years later, he sends them a mail bomb. This was after being their friend. He knew Jeanette, and he knew Marius Schoon. And he sent a mail bomb to their house, and he killed Jeanette and their six-year-old daughter, Catherine. Just really heinous crimes. The South African government, or someone in it, also sent a mail bomb to a guy named Father Michael Lapsley. He was an Anglican priest. He lived in Zimbabwe in exile from South Africa. He survived his attack, and he gave testimony to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. It blew off his hands, the mail bomb, and they never figured out who did it because the perpetrator never came forward. But these were the types of things that were going on in South Africa if you spoke out against apartheid, and if you were known as an opponent to apartheid. You could get a mail bomb at your house, or you could be disappeared in prison. One of the more famous cases of police disappearance was that of the PEBCO 3. PEBCO was the Port Elizabeth Black Civic Organization. This was a group that was set up in the city of Port Elizabeth in South Africa. They protested economic injustice, they protested racial injustice, and three of its leaders, Sifo Hashe, Champion Galela, and Kakawuli Godolozi, set up PEBCO to protest the South African government. They were very prominent activists, and because of that, it kind of got a spotlight on them from the police intelligence service. A special unit of the South African police was organized by Colonel Eugene de Kock, who is sometimes known as Prime Evil. This guy was, I think, just absolutely heartless in his treatment of opponents to the apartheid regime. He ran his intelligence unit out of a farm called Flock Plaas. And Flock Plaas was kind of a super spy HQ where the South African government would organize disappearances, mail bombs, assassinations, really underhanded stuff like that. And one of the things that they organized at Flock Plaas was the disappearance of the PEBCO 3, you know, those three founders of the civic organization in Port Elizabeth, Hashe, Galela, and Godolozi. They were kidnapped from the airport in Port Elizabeth, taken to Flock Plaas, and in 1985, they were beaten to death by security guards. This all came out during the Truth and Reconciliation Commission because of this security officer named Joe Mamasela. Mamasela was a black man, but he worked for Flock Plaas, and he did a lot of their dirty work. Mamasela took orders from Eugene de Kock and said that if he didn't, he would have been killed himself. But he was responsible for a lot of these disappearances. Another organization that is similar to Flock Plaas, but this was on the military level, is the Civil Cooperation Bureau. Now, this was just a straight-up death squad. It was run by the military. They carried out numerous assassinations, especially throughout the 1980s. Starting in the 1990s, I think the National Party kind of, or at least some of their leaders, realized that this was going to come to an end, and they had to make some kind of concession. So in 1990, the ANC is unbanned, but when that happens, there are other white supremacist elements in white South Africa that feel like the National Party has betrayed them. And some of these people started to coalesce to the Conservative Party. This was like a white right-wing opposition to the right-wing National Party. These were people that felt like there could be no concessions made. There were some acts of political violence throughout the 90s carried out by groups like this. One of them, probably the most high-profile one, was the murder of a man named Chris Hani. This happened in 1993. Chris Hani was a monumental figure in South African politics at that time. He was the head of the South African Communist Party, which was an ally to the ANC. And people thought Chris Hani could have been president. Hani had a very large following. He also had been chief of Umkhonto we Sizwe, the ANC's military wing, so he was a pretty important guy. And unfortunately, that's what got him killed, too. In 1993, Chris Hani was shot at his own home by a Polish immigrant named Janusz Walusz. And I bring this up in part because Janusz Walusz said in his TRC interview that he tried to join Saimar in 1989. And this is actually one of the ways that Susan Williams found out Saimar is a real organization, because the assassin of Chris Hani tried to join this mercenary organization called the South African Institute of Maritime Research in the late 80s. So Janusz Walusz killed Chris Hani, and it came out that he was given directions to Chris Hani's house and given the gun itself by a man named Clive Darby Lewis. Clive Darby Lewis was a member of parliament in South Africa. He was a leader in the Conservative Party, and he openly testified to the TRC that, yes, he helped murder Chris Hani, and he did it as a political act, and he was trying to get amnesty. He was denied amnesty because he was a little cagey in his testimony. You can see some of it online. It became clear to the commission that he lied during his testimony to cover for his wife, who apparently was involved in some way. But supporters of apartheid South Africa didn't just commit these crimes at home. They also committed them abroad. Now remember, this idea of total onslaught that required a total strategy, this was very tied into the Cold War. And you can see this in one incident from 1981. And that is the attempted coup of the Seychelles. The Seychelles are a small island group off the coast of Madagascar. In the late 1970s, they had a coup that replaced their right-wing government, which was pro-apartheid South Africa, with a left-wing government that was anti-apartheid South Africa. And the anti-apartheid left-wing president of the Seychelles started to refuse to allow South African commercial jets to refuel at his airport. And this really made a lot of people in apartheid South Africa mad. So in 1981, the Prime Minister of South Africa himself approved a plan to invade and take over the Seychelles in a coup and replace the left-wing president with the previous right-wing one. So the South African government hired this guy named Mike Hoare, that's spelled H-O-A-R-E, and he was a soldier of fortune who operated in places like the Congo War and a lot of wars in Africa during the decolonization period, generally on the right-wing side. Mike Hoare was a white guy who was in favor of white rule in Africa. So this guy organizes a group of mercenaries, most of them from South Africa, and they pretend to be a group called Ye Ancient Order of Frothblowers. That is their cover. This is real. This all actually happened. Ye Ancient Order of Frothblowers is this fraternal organization. They do like charity and they go around drinking beer in other countries. So they were pretending to be this tourist group. They show up to the airport in Seychelles, and one of them can't hide his rifle in his suitcase. He has a rifle butt hiding out of his suitcase as they show up in the airport in Seychelles. And of course, one of the guards notices this, tries to stop him, and their cover is blown. So a firefight breaks out. The South African mercenaries take over the airport, and then some of the leaders split off and hijack a plane to get home. And they leave the rest of the mercenaries stranded. They are captured and they are sent to prison. This experience of being left behind and left to rot makes one of the white mercenaries, this guy Martin Dolinchek, so mad that he defects to the ANC after he gets out of prison. He ends up befriending the left-wing president of Seychelles. He protects him from this other coup that happens, and he goes and joins Umkhonto we Sizwe as soon as he gets out. It's a really fascinating story. And again, there is another connection here to Saimar, because as it happens, at least a couple of the mercenaries involved in the Seychelles coup attempt were members of the South African Institute for Maritime Research. So there's more proof that, yes, this was a real organization. Another thing I'd like to bring up is that Mike Hoare, the guy who planned coups for apartheid South Africa, was also a special consultant for a major motion picture made around the same time called The Wild Geese. This was a Roger Moore movie about white mercenaries in Africa who are somehow the good guys. So they used an actual white mercenary who operated in Africa, paid him money to be their consultant, and I guess did not really think about maybe if this guy had a troubling past. And now, speaking of movies, it's time that I talk about Cold Case Hammarskjöld. That was one of the movies that I used for my source in the previous episode, and I did mention in the last one that, you know, there was kind of a controversy about it when it came out. So now is when I'll talk about that. So the film Cold Case Hammarskjöld, about the second half of the movie, it's all about SIMAR, the South African Institute of Maritime Research, which is a very little known, little understood mercenary organization that was active in South Africa, we know, in the 80s and maybe in the 70s, and maybe it went back all the way to the 1940s. It's not clear. There's not a ton of investigation that's been done on it. But we know for a fact that it did exist, and they may have a connection to the killing of Dag Hammarskjöld. It's not clear. So Cold Case Hammarskjöld, they tracked down some people that knew this guy, Keith Maxwell, who was the head of SIMAR, or one of the heads of SIMAR, it's not really clear, in the early 1990s. One of the things that the filmmakers find from interviewing people that used to live near clinics that Keith Maxwell allegedly ran all over South Africa, allegedly he had these clinics in majority black areas of the country where he would offer free medical services. And it is also known that Keith Maxwell, although he was not mentally stable and was known to make things up, he has written statements that he made musing about this idea of introducing AIDS to black people in Africa to basically carry out a biological genocide. This is an idea he was interested in. They interview people that knew Keith Maxwell, and they mention that he brought up AIDS quite a lot, and he seemed very obsessed with AIDS, and not in like a medical way to help find a cure. Now, I bring this up because when the SIMAR documents were brought to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in 1999, those were those papers that I mentioned in the Dag Hammarskjöld episode where you had that one possibly forged paper that says, like, this is how we killed Dag Hammarskjöld and these other ones that might be real. The woman that brought the papers to the TRC was the mother of a woman named Dagmar Fayle. Dagmar Fayle was a member of SIMAR, and according to her mother, she was working on a project to distribute dummy vaccines throughout Mozambique. And allegedly, these were going to be used to spread HIV. Now, this is what her mother said. Dagmar Fayle was killed. She was murdered, and it has never been solved. And her family believes that it was members of SIMAR murdered her before she was about to go public with this fake vaccination plot. Obviously, when you start talking about conspiracy theories and vaccines, that's very risky business, and so I want to make clear, get your shots, get your flu shot, get your COVID shot, get any vaccine that you need. This is not one of those conspiracy theory podcasts. Like, that's not something that I believe, and it's not something that the makers of Cold Case Hammarskjöld believe. What they did is they investigated this story about Dagmar Fayle. Was this true? Was this South African, possibly government-backed organization trying to spread HIV? Where the controversy comes in is they find someone who claimed to have been a member of SIMAR. He initially denies anything about having to do with AIDS or HIV research. And then when the filmmakers press him on it more, he starts saying all this stuff about how they tried to develop a program to spread HIV, and that in these clinics that Keith Maxwell ran, he was deliberately giving people HIV. Now, the filmmakers pressed him on that, and they weren't exactly clear, and I think that is a fair criticism, because this guy could have been lying, and I think, personally, probably lying about that part, because a lot of scientists spoke up and they said, look, it's not really medically possible to spread HIV like that. You can't really just put it in a vaccine and go give a bunch of people HIV, because it takes millions and millions of dollars to isolate HIV. It's very difficult to keep alive. So, you know, I'm not a scientist, obviously, but I'm convinced it's highly unlikely, if not impossible, that the South African government or the SIMOR organization actually did spread AIDS and HIV as a biological weapon. But that isn't really what the movie alleges. The allegation was that this SIMOR organization tried to do something like that. Whether or not they're successful doing it is another story. Unfortunately, the filmmakers weren't entirely clear about this, and among some audiences, the movie did seem to hint at a man-made AIDS-type conspiracy theory, which the filmmakers have distanced themselves from. That wasn't really what they were trying to get across, but they didn't do a great job. But the issue that I have with some of the reviewers that want to discount all of this as some kind of anti-vaccine stuff is it's not really about vaccines. It's about what was apartheid South Africa capable of? What atrocities were they capable of committing or attempting to commit? And while it's highly unlikely, if not impossible, for them to have actually spread AIDS on purpose, is that something that maybe some of them could have attempted to do? And that's a different question. And that leads me to the last section here, Project Coast. What Project Coast was, it was a secret chemical and biological warfare department under the South African government. Okay, this again sounds like it's fake, but this actually happened. There was a UN report about this. I'm going to link to it in the comments. It's all there. This happened. Project Coast was part of the Total Strategy to oppose total onslaught. And during the 1980s, the South African government began to investigate ways to control crowds with chemical weapons, something like pepper spray, but more powerful. And they began to get together all these scientists, and the person that came to be in charge of it was a man named Wouter Basson. Wouter Basson is a white cardiologist in South Africa. He's still alive. He was put in charge of Project Coast, and like a lot of these secret projects, it was formed under direct orders from high-ranking officials within the South African government, but then they would distance themselves and try to give some kind of plausible deniability and just say, okay, you go do whatever you need to do to get this project done. I don't want to know about it. Here's a ton of money. And that's what they did with Wouter Basson. Basson took the money from the South African government and he used it to found three private labs, and they were all charged with developing chemical and biological weapons for the South African government to use against enemy soldiers, to use against dissidents, and to use against crowds. A lot of this information didn't really come out until the 90s, when Wouter Basson was put on trial for the crimes that he committed under Project Coast. Some of his subordinates testified against him. Basson denied everything up and down, and they couldn't really pin any physical evidence tying him to specific crimes, but it became very clear to the public that, yes, this was the guy that was in charge of South Africa's chemical weapons program, and here are the things that he was responsible for. One, he developed a cocktail of muscle relaxers to give to Namibian prisoners of war, which he injected them with and then dropped their bodies into the Atlantic Ocean. He also imported a ton of cocaine and ecstasy, and that's actually how he got arrested in the 90s, because he was found with several kilos of coke and a ton of ecstasy. Now, he used these drugs either for the purposes of using them for crowd control. He was trying to develop some kind of, like, cocaine bomb or something to use against crowds. It never really worked out. But he also could have just used this to make money, just selling the coke to fund the labs that he set up. At one point, he tried to kill an ANC operative with Mamba venom. He also developed poison weapons to use in assassinations by putting them on umbrella tips or using them in projectiles or coating poison on a screwdriver. One of his colleagues also testified, and this is the weird one, that Wouter Basson told him that he was experimenting in freeze-drying HIV-infected blood, and his plan was to inject a target with it and then have them die of AIDS several years later with no trace leading back to the government. However, this project was abandoned. He also was obsessed, apparently, with an anti-fertility vaccine to give to black women without their knowledge. Now, none of this is to say that people should not get vaccines. What this is to say is that the apartheid government was so racist, its racism was so pervasive, that just this regular cardiologist that the South African government found off the street was obsessed with using the medical practice to either exterminate or punish the black majority population. That, I think, is a completely separate idea from man-made AIDS conspiracies or vaccines conspiracies. That's not a conspiracy. That is just systemic racism that is so pervasive, it was in the medical community itself. And I should say, Basson was acquitted on all those charges, mainly because the prosecution was so bad. And he's still living to this day and still practicing medicine. A big controversy in South Africa right now, this year, is that people found Wouter Basson is still practicing as a doctor. He has a clinic outside of Cape Town, and there is a huge outcry to get him removed and to get his license revoked. So this bonus episode obviously does not cover all of the crimes of the apartheid regime. There's not nearly enough time for that, and I'm not the person to ask for it. This is mostly just some miscellaneous information that I collected while researching my last episode, and I'll link to some sources in the description. Unfortunately, my major source for this episode, TRC Special Report, it's on YouTube, but it's a little funky. I think they uploaded it on there in the early days of YouTube. There's about 80 episodes, but they're all split up into tiny chunks. I think the easiest thing that you can do is just go to the South African Broadcasting Channel YouTube page, or just Google search TRC Episode 1, Part 1, and just kind of start from there. But it's a really well-made program. I learned a lot. I hope you check it out and learn a lot yourself. Once again, thanks for listening.